wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host for this morning, and making possible the program with her engineering is Patricia Kohlberg. You'll hear Patricia's voice later in the program as well. We have a partial theme on today's program, a focus on this year, 2020. Our regular segment, Another World is Possible, will resume the discussion of a dystopian novel written a while ago, but set in 2020. That's Goodman 2020 by Fred Feil. And our music today will commemorate the centenary of an important piece of music, important socially as well as culturally, Crazy Blues, recorded by Mamie Smith exactly 100 years ago in 1920. Before we get to those, Bill Resnick will talk with Effie Baum of Portland's Pop Mob about how to understand violence as part of the ongoing protests. And Desiree Hellegers will talk with Nimipu author Julian Ankeny. As part of that conversation, Ankeny will read passages from her memoirs. Today is part of the KBOO fall fundraising drive. As you know, our station is an extraordinary resource for the community, providing thoughtful coverage of what's covered only superficially elsewhere, or isn't covered at all. I was recently asked to comment on a popular book purporting to offer 20 lessons in how to resist the growing trend toward fascism in our country. One of its lessons was support the mainstream media as the source of reliable news. But in later chapters, this very same book went on to acknowledge the multiple ways mainstream media distorted the news in enabling Trump's 2016 victory. It is alternative media of which you are listening to one of the country's outstanding examples that provides not only reliable news, but needed perspective. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online, or you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Community radio around the country has been forced to cut back or close. The dedicated staff and volunteers here in Portland have kept KBOO going strong. If you're able, please help. That's at kboo.fm/give or mail a check to the station. Thank you. Let's start out the program with Crazy Blues. I'll have more to say on what the song represents, but here, to begin our program, is Just a Tease. That was the beginning of Crazy Blues. More of it and more on it coming up later. Now here's Bill Resnick with Effie Baum.
Hi, Effie Baum. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Effie Baum is a Portland activist, a resident physician. She's also one of the spokespeople for Portland Pop Mob. I talked to Effie, I think last March, in the early stages of the COVID epidemic. We then discussed mutual aid and how the local Pop Mob in North Portland were making face masks and preparing hand sanitizers. Today we're going to talk about another danger, even worse. That's the danger of Trump getting a second term and what Portland activists are doing about it. And we're going to evaluate the impact of Portland's response and how Trump has singled out our peaceful sort of peaceful rural city, peaceful one for the police and troopers. Before we get into evaluating our protest and what we can do, tell us about Pop Mob.
Pop Mob originally formed a little over 2 years ago now, in 2018, in response to all of the violent far-right rallies that groups like Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys were having in the city. And we wanted to encourage large mass mobilizations of the people of Portland to show up and oppose these groups. And then in the time since then, we've had several events. And then with the pandemic, as you mentioned, we were part of a coalition effort with local medic groups working with folks living outside.
Now let's get into the main issue today. We've all noted that Trump first sent troops to Portland to work with police to dominate the streets and stop the thugs and terrorists and antifas. He uses Portland as an example of how weak public officials, Democrats, some communistic, have allowed the thugs and terrorists to take over the city. And that could come to you and your beautiful houses and the affluent areas and suburbs. Effie, what do you make of that whole episode in Portland and American life, of Trump's response to Portland?
Well, I mean, it's not exactly new. He did the same thing last year after the rally where Andy Ngo had an unfortunate run-in with a milkshake. He said the same thing back then. This is rhetoric that he has been using for quite a while now as a way to kind of villainize anti-fascist activists and anybody who is doing work that pushes back against the power structure that he does so much work to uphold. There's actually a really funny thing recently where Tucker Carlson, when he was covering the protests, actually referred to the protesters as violent Biden supporters, which was particularly hilarious because I would say that a large number of the people he was highlighting were probably not exactly Biden supporters. But it was hilarious that that is how they were characterizing it, as these violent Democrats, when a lot of us don't actually adhere to much faith in electoral politics. And speaking for myself, I definitely do not identify as a Democrat. But the rhetoric of people being violent, when largely what we're seeing is people engaged in property destruction and they are characterizing property destruction as violence, I would definitely push back on that characterization. The work of the state to maintain inequality and continue to prop up a violent white supremacist system in which inequality is inherent is a lot more violent than a few broken windows. And the lives of all of the people that have been murdered by the police can never be brought back, but we can wash off graffiti. So the false equivalence of the activities of people that are justifiably angry and the violence perfpetrated by the state is it's absolutely a false equivalency.
You know, Martin Luther King Jr. is credited with saying, violence is the language of the unheard. And the property damage which has happened in Portland was largely confined, it seems to me, to the first night, on the same way after the George Floyd videos were shown and the Breonna Taylor and all of the others. It was somewhat like that first night around the country. It was something like Ferguson erupting after Michael Brown, and then Minneapolis erupting after George Floyd. It seems to me that that violence was, and the looting, some of it, of course, done by agent provocateurs, apparently, which is a real problem, but the violence was very minimal and sort of performative. And also the violence directed towards upscale clothing and jewelry store windows is in some ways an attack on the system of privilege.
Absolutely.
Places. But the violence is mostly like performative. It's not against people. But the problem is that the videos, especially when the stuff goes on at night, the videographers get behind a dumpster which was set on fire, and they take pictures then of the police and troops wading in and hitting and people resisting to some extent, like the moms and the veterans here. Those videos, they make it appear that what the police are doing is fighting back in a scene of hellish sort of fires. Because the dumpster fires, they affect the film, and it makes the whole film seem like an inferno in the city. And they use those pictures over and over and over again. And I do wish that people wouldn't set little fires in a dumpster.
Well, I would say that we support a diversity of tactics, so we don't generally choose to criticize the different tactics that people use when we are all trying to fight for essentially the same end goal, which is, you know, an end to a violent system that results in the death of a lot of people and also in upholding systems of inequality that affect people every day. And so I want to be very clear that Pop Mob did not organize any of the events over the summer. We have been very intentional about operating in an entirely support role, supporting the Black and BIPOC-led organizations that were doing the organizing and the events over the summer, because we have a very narrow mission, which is to encourage people to oppose the far right. And so until this last weekend and like the few weeks, month before this, when we started seeing the Proud Boys and the far right groups starting to show up and harass people and shooting into crowds and having their, you know, little Proud Boy event at Delta Park, until that started happening, we had been operating essentially in a entirely support capacity by boosting events and using our social media as a way to uplift the voices of the people doing all of the work. So I just want to make a very clear distinction there. But the groups that had been making the hand sanitizer switched operations in their lab to making wipes for tear gas and pepper spray. So there's a lot of mutual aid efforts that are still going on as well. And I think that is something that does get overlooked when they are characterizing Portland as this den of violence and anarchy, when in fact there's a lot of coalition building and mutual aid efforts that are happening. And it is actually an amazing thing that we have sustained so many nights of protests as a community that, like you mentioned, the moms and the vets, and that the amount of people coming out waxes and wanes, but there has been a continued effort to continue this conversation about the police, and conversations about defunding the police and police abolition have been a part of national conversation in a way that we've never seen before. And that it is largely because of these protests. If it had been something that had happened for a couple of days and then just ended, we would have hit the next news cycle and people would not be having these vital conversations.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Effie Baum of Pop Mob, a mutual aid organization with ties to the Portland activist left that has been challenging the police and federal government in the streets and refusing to be bullied into silence. It's quite amazing, actually, what's happened. We've so far been discussing how best to challenge the police and troops, and if we should try to control those really angry people. And again, violence is the language of the angry and the unheard. Should we try to control them, and how, in fact? I think there's sometimes it's good to help people see that in the long term, some of the violence is not useful. Although, of course, it is useful to draw attention. If Ferguson hadn't erupted, if Minneapolis hadn't erupted, if the other cities hadn't erupted, and there was, in fact, even some looting and a few broken windows, almost no injuries to people. Anyway, Effie, sometimes there is actual violence by our groups, like when the Proud Boys and Trumpies come to Portland to martyr themselves and build their movements. Sometimes the Proud Boys have succeeded in making spectacles of violence. And they provoke it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there, actually, watching them do it. They do it right in plain sight of the police and others. Anyway, I think sometimes we shouldn't be responding to them. Being very determined, having very large crowds on our side, but maybe not engaging them physically.
I think the false equivalency that gets drawn between the right and the left when it comes to these violent altercations is that there's violence on both sides. And I would argue instead that you have one group that is attacking vulnerable people, whether it's based on race or sexual orientation, or they're trans or they're immigrants. And then you have a group of people that say, no, we're not going to allow this, and that we are going to stop you by any means necessary, and we are going to do what we have to protect our neighbors and our friends and our families. And comparing community self-defense to a violent threat is two completely different things. they do come looking for violence and they are met with community members who are willing to put their own safety at risk to protect the other people who can't do that work. We see the folks that do that as our front lines. And honestly, we could not be out there having protests and demonstrating. And for those of us that don't have the capacity to be in the front lines, we wouldn't even be safe to show up without those folks doing that to provide that line of defense for us.
I think
so that's
you're
the
right.
First point that I would make.
We have to see it in terms of community self-defense, particularly when they come in provocatively and threateningly and show their weapons. It seems to me it's very important to challenge them. They cannot be allowed to roam indiscriminately in the streets.
And when you said that maybe we shouldn't engage with them in that way, what we have seen, in fact, is that if you just ignore them, that they will find targets. And if they do not get the conflict that they are looking for, they will go looking for it. And, you know, we saw this in May Day of 2019 when it was not a march that year downtown, but there was a group of far right people from an organization that's trying to call themselves Patriots United, but then there's also a contingent of Proud Boys that day that showed up expecting the typical May Day march and wanting to attack the quote-unquote communists and defend Portland. But instead, what happened was a labor rally at a park in Northeast. And so instead, they waited for after that when all of the organizers and people in the community had a after party event at Cider Riot where there was bands playing and people tabling and people like hanging out on the patio drinking beer and eating tacos. And then they came and just violently attacked all of the people that were just hanging out at this bar because they did not get the fight that they were looking for earlier. And so this idea that they will just go away is time and again does not pan out. They will keep looking for a fight. And if that means that they are attacking vulnerable people, then that is something that needs to be pushed back against. And the rally this last weekend is also another good example of that. They had people patrolling their perimeter with baseball bats. And you compare that to the rally that we had in Peninsula Park, where there was people giving out food and making things, and there were speakers and there was music and such a display of like community and unity and mutual aid, and the sharp contrast between that and a bunch of men with baseball bats and shields. And there was a video of one of them attacking a journalist and kicking him in the face. And that journalist ended up having to go to the hospital. And I don't see the outrage around that we saw around when Andy Ngo was attacked last year. This guy isn't getting a GoFundMe raising $500,000. And he's not on every news station across the country right now. That video is horrifying. And I would argue it is way more horrifying than what happened to Andy Ngo, but it's not getting the same level of attention. And it's that whole if it bleeds, it leads thing. And there's definitely a propensity of the media to only pay attention when there is an altercation and rampant violence. And the fact that we had a very well-attended and largely positive community event on Saturday barely made ripples because it did not have the if it bleeds, it leads drama that the media loves to portray.
I guess the next test is going to be probably on election day and election night and then the aftermath of the election when Trump and his followers decide that the election was rigged against Trump and they are going to maybe force the issue into the Supreme Court that Trump now owns. It's a serious threat, it seems to me. We can't talk about it today, but people are organizing across the country to deal with it. You'll hear more about that on this Old Mole show and on KBOO. Effie, maybe we can talk another time about how to respond to Trump's people who will be in the streets on election day trying to intimidate people from voting. That's coming up. Effie Baum, really good talking to you again.
Great talking to you too, Bill.
Keep up your various areas of good work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Right. So long.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Effie Baum. You're listening to KBOO FM 90.7 in Portland. Now, Desiree Helliger's host, Nimi Pu author, Julian Ankeny.
guest today is Julian Ankeny, who teaches courses in Native American literature, creative writing, and Nimiipuu or Nez Perce language and cultural reclamation, revitalization, and learning at Washington State University. Julian has presented on Nimiipuu culture and storytelling, both regionally and nationally. On October 29th, she will be performing at UC Berkeley alongside author and UC Berkeley professor Beth Piatote, and with members of a recently formed Nez Perce Writing and Language Revitalization Group that will share new work reflecting on woven corn husk bags. Readings of these works will tie together histories of these objects and contemporary perspectives on Nimiipuu language, community, and culture. This event is presented alongside Berkeley's Hearst Museum online exhibit, Cloth That Stretches, Weaving Community Across Time and Space, which explores textiles as a site of identity formation and cultural resilience. Julian's going to be talking today about her memoir, In Process, A Bouquet of Frogs. Julian, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Link reading at Berkeley is going to be available online, right?
Yes, I think there's a link for registration, and then they send you the link for the talk.
So we'll post that link along with the segment. So we've been planning to do this interview for a few months, and quite coincidentally, it turns out that we're speaking today on the anniversary of the 1877 surrender of Chief Joseph, who together with a band of Nimiipuu Wallawas, estimated at about 750, managed for months to keep a far larger complement of U.S. cavalry at bay before they were forced to surrender about 30 miles from the Canadian border. So your work really takes up the contemporary struggles of the Nimiipuu for self-determination against all odds, and including against the legacy of toxic masculinity and of racism and sexism that you experienced in school. And you also write pretty extensively about the toxic masculinity that you encountered from your abusive stepfather, who was a Marine Corps vet. So just really, you know, foregrounding the fact that that toxic masculinity, you know, it's part of the legacy of colonialism and was not a pattern of gendered relations traditionally. So you're going to read us a little section from your memoir?
Yes, I am. Tatsiaoyao, thank you.
Tatsiaoyao.
A Bouquet of Frogs. The Rules of Eating. Did you just look at the TV? He barked. Bits of food sprayed from his flapping jowls. No, I said, with my head turned down, replying to my plate and not the man. Downturned eyes, downturned down. I was really examining my hamburger patty in the thick brown gravy nestled in a fat mound of very lumpy Idaho gold potatoes. I liked the lumps, though. They were solid, not mixed in. Those potato pieces were spared the beating of the wire whisk. They were definitely not beaten enough. That was the motto of my stepfather. What did you say to me? He belched out. I could see the brimstone burning inside his eyes. One look could turn any child into dust. No, I said, after a moment, trying to gulp down the last of my potatoes. Look again and you'll get the belt. Yellow sulfur fumes began rising from his nostrils. Before the retribution was dealt, the less fortunate, he liked to slowly take off his brown leather work belt. The belt slithered around his waist like a snake. He would fold it in half to form a loop in between his hands. Making the belt loose, in one fell motion, he would extend his arm so the belt came together in a terrifying snap. It made a person jump every time. The sound was scary enough, let alone feeling its wrath. His words were like that belt, so harsh, like a slap across the face. Look again. I shifted my eyes from him to look at my mother. She just sat there, peaceful creature that she was. She considered herself Catholic, though Mass was never a regular occurrence, except for Easter Sundays. It is hard to eat and pray at the same time, I am assuming. Her eyes were closed and she gulped down some of the meat and swallowed her voice with it. Our Father, who art at the head of the dinner table, hallowed be thy cursed name. Thy kingdom come, thy will not be done, on earth as it is in this living hell. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive thy stepfather who has trespassed against us. And led us into temptation, but delivered us from his evil. Amen. Children were not supposed to even look at the television when we were seated at the dinner table. But I had to have one last glance of defiance. Turn the TV off, he said. Only he was allowed to talk. We were supposed to eat in complete silence. The television was switched off with the remote immediately. We sat there, my stepfather, my mother, sister, and me. The only parts of our fragile bodies left moving were our silent mouths. Only the sound of chewing was heard. I looked at my stepfather. He was staring at me from the head of the table. I was sitting at the other end, looking directly back at him. His eyes shone like the fiery black obsidian. I couldn't help but to dissect him like a frog in biology class. We looked into each other's eyes. I saw the whiteness of his sclera start to dissolve, just like the dead frog's eyes. His pupils quivering engulfed the light white, and I could only stare into that blackness. All the blackness of the universe was in those eyes. I knew he wanted me to say one more word so he could spank me, but I didn't have the strength of will yet. I would lose sight of all time and place as everything around me slowly turned to the gray-black mold that engulfs dead flowers when they have been left in a vase with water too long. What did my mother see in him? I never got the chance to ask her that question because what I saw was what was much worse. I had no context for the role of a female child and how she should be treated by a step-parent. I didn't know that these childhood experiences were shaping the way I would reproduce and perform the gendered identities assigned to me. I learned to do things in silence. I sat in silence. I was subservient. I was submissive and surviving, remaining unheard for most of my young life. I was trying to survive the devil's dealings at 10 years old. How to kill a fish. The directions on the side of the box specifically state that some experiments are doomed to repeat themselves. Salt the meat and then salt the vegetables. Salt kills the germs on the vegetables. Salt is the purifier. It is the cure. Salt the lettuce before eating, letting the lettuce stay crisp for the most delectable salad your mother never taught you how to make. Rinse the salt off with cold water. Salting vegetables helps to prevent certain types of bacteria that could easily break a young family apart. Then lay the preparation aside for about 4 years to ruminate after the first ignition of a child's soul. On a dry, clean surface, prepare your other ingredients for chopping. Chop onion, garlic, and the secret ingredient, minced very fine, and add them to one happily bloody ground deer burger. It's that simple. I had been researching medicinal herbs for quite some time in the seventh grade, taking careful note of the poisonous ones. The herbs were to be part of a different type of potion and tonic that I could only imagine selecting, searching, finding, and harvesting at the precise moment of utmost potency for the uniquely wild attributes to work. The plant I found in medicinal and poisonous herbs of the Northwest. And they were all right in my own backyard. My very own indigenous plant supply was at my fingertips. Easily accessible for a preteen to gather, a nice patch of Jimson weed grew across the gravel alley and lay in wait side of what is now a used tire shop. Nestled by the concrete slabs, growing slowly inch by inch, growing with its curlicue vine, searching for new lands to explore, was the weed. It had its own manifest destiny, new crevices to hide in, get buried in, reaching its tendrils up so softly, touching and grasping at the hem of my pants, as if to let me know it was there just for me, reminding me, don't go. Maybe even placed there by God, the key ingredient to make my meal complete, lay the plant. Among the white trumpets of flowers, those gigantic evangeline chalices of angels making sounds of heavenly psalms was God's handiwork. The huge, soft, and inviting green velvet, broad, heart-shaped leaves shrouded the colossal pods. They were 2.5 inches in diameter and perfectly round. The bulbous seed pods grew covered in half-inch spikes of pod protection, nature's natural defense for the seeds and their continued population on Earth. The dried and ground-up seeds could be used for the darkest arts of food preparation. These were the pods of my retribution, my contribution to society to end a man's life.
Julian, thanks so much for this really remarkable work and this description of plotting to poison your stepfather. And your memoir also deals with the experience of having lost 3 children as a result of a lack of access to quality health care. And certainly that lack of access to quality health care is the norm in Indian country and accounts at least in part for the far higher rates of mortality compared to white Americans. There's a lot of imagery of frogs in here, and the memoir itself is called A Bouquet of Frogs.
I draw inspiration from our Nimiipuu Timt, Nimiipuu Tetwatit, our stories. And so the story that always constantly stalks me is Sun, Moon, and Frog Girl. Frogs are, they're just everywhere. They're in my backyard. They call to me.
It's definitely a story of a kid really fighting back against elements of colonial violence that find their way into the home.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people only focus on like physical violence, but a lot of the time paired with that physical violence is also like mental abuse. And that in a lot of ways, that mental abuse really stays with you. And we can tend to dwell there. And writing some of that out and expressing that fact of patriarchal violence that stems from colonial violence, it's something that happens to so many people. And I think that people are scared to talk about it. There's so much richness to be shared and to learn from.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Audre Lorde's kind of adage, you know, your silence will not protect you. So this is such a powerful memoir, and it emerges against all odds and despite, you know, many, many ways in which people attempt to silence you, including Teacher that you write about really powerfully. Thank you again, Julian, for joining me today. My guest today has been Julian Ankeny, who teaches at Washington State University. Julian, thank you so much.
Katsiao-yao. Thank you, Desiree.
And we'll be talking again soon. So we look forward to that. Thanks so much, Julian. Katsiao-yao.
Katsiao-yao. Thank you.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Desiree Heligers and Julian Ankney. We come now to the fifth episode in our series, Another World is Possible. I called this episode of Another World is Possible, Goodman 2020, Part 2. Goodman 2020 being a dystopian novel by Fred Feil, written in the late 1970s and early 80s, and set in this very year, 2020. To listen to Part 1, go to the Old Mole Variety Hour website for the August 10th program. In Part 1, I posed a question to Old Mole listeners. If you knew two or three decades ago what you know now about the ways our society has gone off the rails, the vastly increased social and economic inequities, the political authoritarianism, the racial and gender repressiveness, the environmental depredation. If you had been alive then and able to foresee all of that, how would it have affected the choices you've made? Would you have acted differently then and in the interim than you have? Would you have devoted your life any differently? I called this the Cassandra problem, Cassandra being the woman of ancient Troy, gifted by the gods with the ability to foretell the future, but punished by them by having nobody believe any of her prophecies. Isn't this close to the challenge faced by writers of dystopias? Fred Feil, or his near contemporary Octavia Butler, sought out underlying tendencies in the society in which they lived and projected them into the future as warnings to their contemporaries. Some writers of dystopias project far into the future, but Fred Feil and Octavia Butler set their warnings in our own times. 2020 for Feil, 2023 for Butler. Why aim for now? For one thing, think of the significance of 2020. As well as a calendar year, it's a synonym for clear vision. Feil's protagonist comes to see, to understand, how the horrors of the society, the environmental devastation, the poverty and racism, the runaway capital and joblessness, the exploitation of other countries, the corporate control of politics, are all linked to each other and based in a system which aims to commodify everything, including friendship, to turn everything into profits for a small elite. Here's how Ernest Goodman comes to understand the systemic nature of the problem as he meets the powerful CEO who's hired him as a paid friend.
If power is the charge in a grid work, and we occupy the junctures of the grid, if power passes through us to be redirected, dispersed, passed along, if no one in any position on the grid holds power, if power holds us, if this is true, then it may be misleading to speak of the inner character, the soul of a corporate president. Not only because it is not he himself who is important, his temperament, personality, etc., as opposed to his position on the grid, but because it may be that in that position, his power, the sheer overcharged aggregate of the entire system directed to his juncture, to him, may have long since burnt away any inner being he might once have had. He will, no doubt, retain his small likes and dislikes, a taste for veal, a predilection for certain body types, a sad fondness at the cry of a mourning dove. He will, always at some risk and expense, have his own private games for restoring some vestigial sense of self. Yet he, more so than the lowliest worker in Brazil or Taiwan, will have no real identity apart from his position on the grid. The name of the man at the head of the table is Richard Dick Devine.
There's another reason for setting the dystopia in the near term. to motivate at least the possibility of action. If you were writing a novel meant to warn your contemporaries about what's to come, and you set it 300 years in the future, with interplanetary commuting and races of attacking robots, it's harder to know how to resist now, where to even find glimmers of hope. And what about hope? There's a convention in much of dystopian literature that love between two individuals provides a sanctuary from the overwhelming forces outside and a base for resistance, however vulnerable, temporary, or illusory. In Goodman 2020, love is difficult, is impacted by the distorted society around it, but is nevertheless a place to come home to until it isn't. Here, from the point of view of Goodman's lover, is what the commodification of everything, the turning even of relationships into profit opportunities, has meant for the possibility of intimacy, both emotional and sexual.
Overdefined by the past, unable to become a consumer like the rest, yet the present sucks the past dry, empties out the concepts of husband, lover, marriage, family she has tried to keep full. And by 2020, there is no movement that will help her see first the corruption in the concepts themselves, then their necessary erosion as the system first uses up love as an advertising ploy, then eliminates the economic dependence that underpins marriage and the family by depriving virtually everyone of a job. Now, within that system's inner circle, everyone, except the few men at the very top, is roughly equal before the neuter desire to get, to buy, to use up. Now, though occasionally a few corporate wives still get together in groups to talk about themselves and their men, women's liberation has dribbled away. There is no defense for her against the way the present guts her past. No future she can dream.
Both Ernest Goodman's vulnerability to corporate manipulation and his resistance to being turned into a cog in that soulless system come from his attachment to the distorted but yet real love for his partner and her son. In Goodman 2020, the author doesn't turn love into the saving grace. It's the deliberate corporate destruction of that love in order more completely to control Goodman that's the stimulus to revolt. And the hope comes from the possibility of solidarity among the marginalized, the excluded. Goodman gets an unexpected early glimpse of these folks on his first travel in the corporate jet.
When he twists his oddly heavy head to look out the wide paneling, he does not see the city he could recognize. No, not the official city of malls, trans, financial and residential districts, butting up against a few somewhat more dangerous zones. But that city, all of it, like the edge of a thumbnail on the tip of the bay, pressed to its edge by the splay of the thousands of houses, shacks, huts, the patterned maze extending down the peninsula, even now as far as he can see, until the jet reaches the clouds and the picture is blotted out. And in that second, Ernest has seen the whole city, its invisible part too, the part of it that used to be working and middle-class suburbs, now a lush forest of human beings, Chicanos and blacks and everyone else who is allowed to live there, crossing the border zones in broad daylight if they have to reach the city, you can't stop them, living in their self-built shacks with 3, 4, 5 other families in the gutted remains of suburban tracts, now without plumbing, heating, water, electricity. Such areas exist in every major American city in 2020-21. though in the case of San Francisco, the peninsula serves to restrict their growth somewhat. But even in the Bay Area, they have been a security nightmare ever since the decline of the automobile, the race for the few remaining jobs, and the rush to defend the nation's business and financial centers in the panics and riots of the late 90s. The borders must be kept heavily guarded. They must not be allowed in, either to get or to ruin anything. We must not acknowledge their presence at all. And so Ernest is shocked and does not know what to do with the sight, any more than we know what to do with the pictures of the packing case huts next to those high-rises in Rio or Manila or Lagos today. The clouds swallow him up and the plane levels out and takes off straight forward, and he turns to talk to his client.
I'm not going to tell you the plot details of how Fred File marinates his bleak 2020 warning with a smidgen of hopefulness. Only this, that a good outcome, a decent society, is far from assured, but that solidarity is possible, especially across racial lines, and therein lies our hope. It's a strong and appropriate message from a writer decades back, forecasting what we'd face in our year of dystopia, 2020. Fred File wrote Goodman 2020 so that we'd know another world is possible. I promised you some music this morning and some background. Here we go. Crazy Blues. The year was 1920, and think for a moment what had been happening. We've talked on this very program about the 1919 Seattle general strike, when workers took over and peacefully ran the entire city, about the Palmer raids that targeted immigrants and radicals that same year, about the dread inspired in the economic elites by the recent Russian Revolution, about the flu pandemic, an economic slump that followed World War I. All of this had profound implications for Black Americans. A labor shortage during the war brought Southern Blacks to the North, beginning what became known as the Great Migration. When the war ended and soldiers returned, there was competition for housing and jobs, as they had before the war with different ethnic groups. Employers deliberately pitted Black and white workers against each other. Some of the returning soldiers were Black combat veterans. In 1919, there were race riots against Blacks in 37 U.S. cities, with hundreds killed and dozens grotesquely lynched. For the first time since Reconstruction, Blacks widely fought back. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "We return from the slavery of uniform, which the world's madness demanded us to don, to the freedom of civil garb. We stand again to look America squarely in the face. We sing, this country of ours, despite all its better souls have done and dreamed, is yet a shameful land. We return. We return from fighting. We return fighting." J. Edgar Hoover, who went on to head the FBI, got his start by analyzing Black resistance for the U.S. Attorney General. His analysis, with the stereotypes that say so much more about the analyst than about reality, blamed the white riots against Blacks on, quote, "numerous assaults committed by Negroes upon white women," unquote. This is the context in which Perry Bradford wrote and Mamie Smith recorded Crazy Blues. Listen closely to the lyrics when she sings about the man I love. Is she talking only about an individual relationship? Or could she be talking about this country or white America? When she says, "What you're going to need is an undertaker man," is the defiance solely individual, or is it social? How about her line, "Get myself a gun and shoot myself a cop"? Selling 75,000 copies in its first month and millions thereafter, Crazy Blues became an anthem for Black Americans. Here, in its entirety, Crazy Blues, sung by Mamie Smith. That was Crazy Blues, written by Perry Bradford and sung by Mamie Smith. One further comment on its context, not from me, but from a prominent Black poet of that time. At the height of the physical attacks on Black communities in 1919, Claude McKay wrote this poem, "If We Must Die." If we must die, let it be not like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed. In vain, then, even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe, though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow, what though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. I've been talking about Mamie Smith's Crazy Blues, followed by Claude McKay's poem, If We Must Die. I'd like to thank everyone on the show today. Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg, Bill Resnick, Desiree Heligers, and their guests, Effie Baum, Julian Ankeny. And a special thanks to the resourceful staff at KBOO that keeps the station going when so many others around the country have had to close. A reminder, this is fall drive time at KBOO. You can show your support by donating today at kboo.fm/give. As I mentioned, we aren't in the station to take your calls, something we've done for decades, but can't now because of the coronavirus. You can, however, show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give, or you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This is Norm Diamond. Stay safe and stay active.